Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is CBC Radio.
From coast to coast through the CBC Radio network and around the world on shortwave, this is As It Happens.
Good evening, this is As It Happens.
As It Happens.
This is As It Happens.
As It Happens.
Hello.
This is As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happened, the February edition.
It is time once again to put on our protective gear and go looking for treasures in the vast, and a bit mysterious, I could say, As It Happens archives.
For this new archival As It Happened podcast, we don't venture back that far, which is good because there are fewer spiders this way. We'll be revisiting some of the most fascinating and surprising conversations from the past month, as well as dusting off a few gems from our archives.
In February, we heard firsthand about all kinds of firsts, including my conversation with a couple of researchers who are also a couple, who explained where and how and why humans first started kissing.
And the artful dogger from 1974, we'll hear from a woman whose Afghan hound won first prize at a local art show for a nibbled and gnawed masterpiece.
But first, a story about a dream come true for a Canadian hockey player who made his NHL debut for his hometown team.
Those stories and more on this February edition of the As It Happened podcast. It's not new for Kuldeep Bains to sit in the stands and watch his son take the ice. He's been doing it since Archdeep Bains first picked up a hockey stick and started playing in front of their home in Surrey, BC, less than an hour's drive away from Vancouver. At a young age, Archdeep's talent was obvious, and as he pursued a professional hockey career, his father was familiar with seeing his son hit milestone after milestone, and then, for the first time, Kuldeep Bains sat in the stands in an NHL arena, proudly wearing a Vancouver Canucks jersey with the name Bains on the back, and watched Archdeep fulfill his childhood dream.
Kuldeep, what were you feeling when Archdeep took to the ice last night for the first time in his NHL game?
You know, it was just a special feelings for us in the family hall. We were waiting for this moment for all this, last so many years that he's accomplishing his dream right now. You know, he's just stepping into the ice. It's just the best feeling ever.
he went undrafted at both the WHL level and the NHL level. He's had to really work hard to prove he's worth it at this level. How big of an achievement is this for him to play in last night's game and then within that game to not look out of place at all?
Yeah, that was huge. Like, you know, it was very huge, big for him. Like, you know, right from the beginning, like, you know, everything he did, he has to earn it. Like, you know, like he's dedicated, like, you know, hard worker right from the beginning. Like, you know, the kids would be having a fun out there, like, you know, in their young life, like, but he was always working hard for this his dream. And early mornings, he's, you know, up and go to his trainings and to his practices, whatever is there. Like, you know, hockey to him, like, you know, the working hard to him was the first, then everything else, you know, scheduled around it. Like, you know, same with our family, you know, everything we knew the schedule was there, everything else was beside it. So that's how huge it was for him.
You know, hockey parents, it's a notorious, a famous amount of sacrifice with the early mornings, the travel, the amount of work that goes into getting your kid in a position to work that hard is a lot. What made you willing to do that, to put in the hours to help him get there?
Well, I had a little bit of a, you know, myself was, into sports, a little bit into sports too. I like the team, like the Canucks, you know, home team here, Canucks, and sports was in me too a little bit, so I put a little bit of extra effort, like, you know, this, you know, let's say, you know, I see myself in him, or like, you know, as I be, you know, father or sure. parents would do that, but, you know, but still, we see a little bit of a special in him here. I go, I'll, you know, I'll go with it, like, you know, give him what he's looking for in the future. And I, you know, thank God, you know, he's there, and, you know, we're beside him to achieve his, you know, goal and going into the, you know, that part into the sports. You know, our community is right behind him too. Like, you know, they're so, all the wishes and goodwill, you know, they're giving us on the phone, and, you know, all this, it's surreal, like, you know, what is going on in our community here.
I bet. It must be even hard to quantify what this means for the South Asian community in BC.
It is, yeah. It's a very special moment for everybody.
Can you see the impact that his, just this week, but his whole career to this point means for other South Asian kids who might kind of dream of making the NHL?
It's huge. Like, you know, that loss from what I've seen and what I've heard from last, you know, few, I'd say a couple of years or like last, you know, especially when he started in AHL, like, you know, what I've heard from everybody, how many younger kids are starting to follow him, and then, you know, and what they all hoping him to make it to the big, and, you know, it's just very, very special.
That was Kuldeep Bains, father of NHL hockey player Archdeep Bains, speaking to guest host Peter Armstrong. Archdeep Bains knew that he'd have to work hard for years to get his shot on the big stage, whereas, by contrast, Fred did absolutely nothing to earn his newfound celebrity status. He's not a meteorologist. He doesn't even know what a meteorologist is. And yet everyone watched him predict the weather. That's fine, though, because Fred is a groundhog. Val d'Espoir, Quebec, was in desperate need of a replacement groundhog called Fred La Marmotte after the previous Fred La Marmotte disappointed and traumatized the community last year. He was found dead just moments before the town's famous Groundhog Day celebration, an event which cast a shadow over the celebration and not the kind of shadow that people had expected. Neil spoke to René Laurendeau, one of the event organizers, a day before the new Fred La Marmotte made his first Groundhog Day appearance.
René, I think it's important to ask straight away, is this new Fred still alive?
Well, so far, yes, definitely. We last year, it was a really bad surprise. Yeah. And, you know, we usually let them sleep. But this year, we kind of checked a little more.
How often? Sure, yeah. When was the last time someone checked?
Last week.
Okay. Well, hopefully things have all continued well over the last several days. We'll see what happens tomorrow. But if we go back a bit, did this Fred have to audition? What is the selection process like for such an important position?
Well, he had to get used to human being.
Right.
So basically, we go to see him, and we take care of him and feed him and get closer and closer. And then after a while, he get used to human being. And then it's possible to have him out to do the prediction.
Right. So this Fred felt comfortable with people, and you think that Fred is up to the challenge?
I think so. He might be a little nervous because he's not used to that many people. Yeah. But you have to understand that we don't awake him way ahead of time, mm-hmm. because the groundhog, they sleep when there is a certain temperature. And what happened is that they're sleeping, and we warn them a little bit up to the time where they awake, and then he does the prediction, and then back into his condo to sleep for the rest of the winter.
Understood. You want it to happen sort of as naturally, I guess, as possible, it sounds like.
Well, yes, we really want him to be as well as possible.
Do you think you might be feeling any pressure to perform here? Because the last Fred had a great track record, 10 out of 13 times Fred was correct. So do you think this one might be a little bit worried about?
It will depend on the weather. We never know.
You know, the meteorologists around the world and in Canada don't love this day that's coming up tomorrow. What do you say to those who dislike all of the attention that Fred and his colleagues get?
Well, maybe they're a little jealous, and also maybe they're a little jealous because Fred so far has the best record there, even better than all those stations. So
tough talk. All right. It's elbows up.
We're the best.
When you...
No pretension. We're the best.
I like it. You know, you mentioned a moment ago that you want to make sure that Fred is okay and you take care of him. His condo is all set up. But, you know, animal activists have some concerns as well. They've said, you know, why not use children? And last year you did do that after the other Fred's unexpected passing. The kid mm-hmm. the child was an emergency replacement. Why not use a child again?
Well, the tradition is the groundhog. Everybody's expecting the groundhog. And, you know, we awake him very slowly, very nicely, and he does his prediction. He goes back to sleep. I'm not sure he even remember he'd done it.
Just comes naturally. You're fine. Yeah. So as press agent for Fred, that's a tough job, I can only imagine. So do you feel like tomorrow you'll be able to relax a little bit once it's all done?
Well, after then, we have a look to what our effect was in the world, because we're seen all over the world. It's really crazy. It's hard to believe that little tiny thing that we started 15 years ago is now spread so much all over the place. So after, yes, we relax, and then just a little sip of wine and a little relaxing time.
That was René Laurendeau, the self-described press agent for Fred La Marmotte, speaking to Neil in February. You're listening to As It Happened, the February edition, where we look and listen back at the previous month on As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
When As It Happens spoke to Benjamin Alexander in 2022, he knew what it was like to do something challenging and unfamiliar for the first time, which can be especially daunting as an adult. For example, recently, I have taken up clockmaking and repair. And as you can hear, I proudly display my work here in the As It Happens studio. It's helpful because it enables Neil and I to know the time, approximately. I think this cuckoo clock loses somewhere around 17 minutes every hour. Still, it is adorable. And I repaired it with my own hands. Ah, no, what is... Oops. Sorry. Cuckoo can be a bit startling. Anyway, at the age of 38, Benjamin Alexander, a former international DJ who had performed at Burning Man, was about to become the first alpine skier to represent Jamaica at the Olympics, which is impressive, and more so considering he only took up the sport at the age of 32. Here is... forever! Excuse me. Here's Benjamin Alexander speaking to Karoloff from our archives.
Benjamin, what are your chances of winning a medal at the Olympics next month?
I would say slim to none, but that would be optimistic. I'm competing with people that have been skiing since they were two, have been racing for 20 years, and have had their National Ski Federation pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into their development. My first race was just 2 years ago, and so my story is really about participation and helping the next generation of Jamaicans do much better than I will do. And I've actually already identified those Jamaicans, so super excited to see their progress.
So tell us about how you got into skiing. Being a Jamaican, I understand you had your first experience on the slopes in Canada.
Yeah, I owe a lot to Canada for my skiing experience. I was invited to a heli-ski lodge in British Columbia, not too far away from Revelstoke, called Micah. And I was just there as a, you know, a house cat, making sure the beer was cold, making sure the jacuzzi was warm, and, you know, eating too much, as you do on a normal Christmas holiday. And on one of the days, they flew us, the house cats, in the helicopter up to the top of the mountain to have lunch with the skiers. And at the end of that lunch, I saw my friends pop on their 130mm powder skis and just disappear over the ridgeline. And I thought that turned them into superheroes. And I decided that very moment that I would not come back to Micah unless I was one of the skiing contingent. And so I had my first ever lesson also in Canada. 2 months later, I'd been around the world since in that 2 month period. I was actually flown back to Canada from Brazil. And in Whistler of February of 2016, family weekend, family day weekend, as you call it in Canada, was my first ever real lesson out on the mountain skiing.
Wow.
So Canada has a big part in my ski history.
This is just a couple of years ago. What was your first run like? Describe how well you did.
I fell 27 times on that first run. And I think most sane people would have said, nope, that's okay. That's not for me. You know, as a 32-year-old falling on the hard ice, I think you just give up. But for me, I graduated from an engineering degree. I have a very logical, rational mindset. And I saw 27 as a baseline number to improve upon and just spent the rest of the day on that very same run. I wanted to limit the variables and just stay on the same run. And I got it down to 7 by the end of the day.
And have you imagined yourself on that slope in China during those Olympics? Have you thought about yourself there?
No, I'm imagining myself in the opening ceremony, hopefully holding the flag and just feeling so relieved and such a sense of accomplishment that I've gotten there. As I said, I'm trying to blaze a path for the next generation of Olympians. I have zero pressure on my performance when I get to the start gate. You know, I'll be 20 seconds behind the winner at best. And I just hope that the performance I deliver is respectable and inspirational enough for other people to take up a sport as late as I did or even later, 32.
Benjamin Alexander speaking to Carol about becoming the first Jamaican alpine skier to compete at the Olympics in 2022. Mr. Alexander didn't earn any medals for Jamaica that year, but, you know, as you heard, he wasn't really expecting to win anything. Julie McDonald had similarly low expectations when she entered an artwork made by her roommate Alexis Boyar into a local art competition. But the judges were profoundly impressed by Alexis Boyar's artistic achievement and judged the work, a chewed-up mitten, to be a masticated masterpiece, to the surprise of Ms. McDonald. But not Alexis Boyar, who didn't know or care due to being a dog. Here are Barbara Frum and Alan Maitland speaking with Julie McDonald about how her Afghan hound won first prize at an art show in 1974.
Hello, Ms. McDonald.
How you do, Alan?
That was a pretty good joke you had, wasn't it?
Well, we've had a pretty good time with it, yes.
You did it as a joke.
Well, you know, it started out as a lark, and then there seemed to be some serious implications, but that's all right, too.
How many mittens did Alexis Boyar have to chew before you got a, in quotes, artistic one?
None. This is his first try, and he's never chewed anything else in his life. I mean, he just saw this thing, and it just struck him that this is what he must do, apparently.
How did it get started?
Well, he picked up this lost mitten in the park last winter and brought it home, and we debated whether to let him have it because we don't like him to get the idea that mittens are for chewing, but it was beyond repair and, you know, lost, so we let him have it. And he just chewed it and pawed at it and tossed it up in the air and just had a wonderful time with it. And this went on for, you know, a matter of weeks or months, and we just let him keep it. And finally we looked at it, and it was sort of interesting.
So it took some time to turn it into an art object.
It wasn't an instant thing, yes.
And then you enrolled it in the exhibit under what title?
It's called Anitra's Dance. We entered it as a wall hanging in the crafts division. We did not call it weaving, which obviously it was not.
And it won.
Well, there were 19 prizes, and it won the Valley Weavers Award. And, of course, some weavers were not accepted, so I'm sure they must not be very pleased. Actually, the ones who objected have been painters and sculptors. Of course, we are turning the prize back to them because we feel that's only fair.
Who went up to collect the prize?
The dog and his master.
That must have been quite a scene. What happened?
Well, of course, we brought the dog to the gallery, and they tried to throw him out, and we assured them it was not against the law for the dog to be there, and so they didn't expect that kind of a response and went away and left him. And then when they called out the award winners, when his name was called, he went. And people standing around just couldn't quite take it in. They didn't know what was happening.
You know, this is even more humiliating than a painting by a chimp. They at least have the brain of a four-year-old.
Oh, yeah, well, you just can't believe what a brain an Afghan's got.
He's a nice-looking dog.
Oh, he's beautiful.
Have you ever entered anything in the show before?
Oh, I don't enter art competition. I review art shows. I do not paint or do any of the visual arts.
Uh-huh.
But I have watched this judging year in and year out, and it just seems that the public often wonders what arcane standards there be. And I thought maybe we could make that a little clearer.
Because you're kind of taking a poke at yourself then, too.
Well, of course.
Well, that's fair enough, then. Why is everybody so mad?
There are a couple of the prize winners who won bigger prizes than the dog did, incidentally, who are quite huffy about it.
What are the critics saying?
They said they didn't feel that you should be ha-ha about such a serious thing. You know, they worked so hard to get where they were and to sort of...
You take it all very seriously, yeah?
Oh, yes, you know. And they talked about fine art, which I think is a terrible phrase. Art is art. Fine has no place in it.
Well, I wonder if your husband didn't compound it by praising the integrity of the jurors.
Well, I suppose this is a possibility.
Did you mount this wall hanging, this weaving?
No, it's just sort of lying there the way he left it. I just picked it up off the floor very gingerly by one little thread and did nothing to alter it whatsoever.
So you didn't stitch it to a canvas or anything?
Nothing. There's no mounting.
What are you going to do with it now?
Well, we're going to hang it in my husband's office. And also, some art teachers presented him with a lovely wooden plaque, which is, you know, burned in the wood and all painted, and it says, Artistic Mitten Mastication Award, Alexis Boyar, 1974. And then they signed their names on the back.
That's terrific.
From our archives, that was Julie McDonald telling As It Happens about how her dog's chewed-up mitten won first prize at a local art show. It's all about firsts when two people enter into a new relationship. Who makes the first move? Where do they go for their first date? And when will they finally smooch for the first time? Well, Sophie Lund Rasmussen and Troels Pank Arbal experienced all of those firsts with each other because they've been together for more than 15 years. And although the two Danish researchers weren't experts in kissing in a professional sense, she studies biology and he studies ancient Mesopotamian languages and writing, the couple found themselves correcting the record on when humans first started kissing.
Sophie, Troels, I think most people just assume kissing has been around forever. Romantic kissing. How were we all so wrong for all this time?
Well, in my field of astrology, where I study the ancient Middle East, we've known for several decades that that the kiss was quite old from our sources. But now we've finally made this information available to the larger public, and it's received great interest.
Sophie, did it surprise you?
Yes, it actually did. And originally, Troels and I were just discussing this published study on herpes virus in the Bronze Age, and came across the claim that the kiss originated in India, 1500 BC. And I thought that was really interesting. And then Troels went, I think I can beat that with 1,000 years. So we just ran upstairs to the office and studied all the sources he remembered.
And a passion project was born. Just that study you were mentioning, that was in 2022. You come across a study on herpes, and that was dating it back to 1500 BC, romantic kissing, as you said. As Troels, you were digging around into other sources. What did you find that brings us to this conversation today?
Yeah, well, so in astrology, we study the world's first written script, or perhaps first written script, the cuneiform writing, which was invented in ancient Iraq circa 3200 BCE and used into the first century in the Common Era. They wrote on clay tablets, so they're incredibly durable. You know, we have a lot of sources available. And when they start formulating, you know, myths and the like around 2600, 2500 BCE, you start to get some juicy stories, you might say. Oh. And one of these revolves around some gods that have intercourse and then kiss afterwards. So this is really evidence of
afterwards.
Of this,
okay, interesting.
Sexual romantic kissing, yeah. Yeah, it seems to be a post-coital activity in the early sources.
Secrets revealed. Is it possible that it may date back even further than what you've dated it back to, 2500 BC, 1,000 years earlier, as you've said, than that original paper you're looking at?
I mean, it's difficult always to date these ancient manuscripts, but obviously it's also possible that some of these stories were even older, of course. And we certainly know from the various studies we went through that there are these biological human behaviors that relate to kissing that seem to go quite far back into prehistory. So I would imagine if we are to search for some sort of origin, we have to go very far back.
And Sophie, biology is your area of expertise. Why do you think romantic kissing came about all of those years ago?
Yes, because, I mean, right now we have mentioned the earliest documentation, as we currently know it, for kissing, sexual romantic kissing. But I think this behavior is way older than that. And the reason why I think so is that when we look at the behavior of our closest living relatives, the chimps and the bonobos, they also engage in sexual kissing. At least the bonobos, they really, really do enjoy sexual kissing. So if they're doing that behavior, it could indicate that this has been around for many, many, many years. And that's really interesting.
You mentioned, you know, trolls, that there were times where the stories might be a little juicy, scandalous, but there were also times where it was considered dangerous.
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's dangerous per se, but we certainly have some, for example, proverbs that says that, well, you shouldn't kiss on the street, for example. And it seems to have been perhaps frowned a bit upon in public. And there are also some indications that... For example, there is this reference that if you kiss a priestess, presumably someone who's not meant to be sexually active, then you might lose your ability to speak afterwards.
The work you're doing together and the information that you've put out there seems more romantic to me. Does it feel that way to the two of you?
It was very nice writing it together, I think, and doing some academic work, because we're both obviously in academia, but in very different fields. So although we often discuss various things we work on independently and get each other's, you could say, interdisciplinary views on thoughts, then we rarely get the opportunity to do something and write something together. And this was just such a wonderful experience, I think.
Yes, it was really a success. And I mean, we didn't file for divorce, so I guess that's a success as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a success. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you both. Trolls, Sophie, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
That was Sophie Lund Rasmussen and Trolls Pank Arbal speaking to Neil in February 2024. That brings us to the end of this special As It Happened podcast.
It was produced by John McGill, Devin Nguyen, and our technician, Renald Gonzalez, with help from us, we try, Zian Iros, and the kind team at CBC Radio Archives.
You can hear another special As It Happened episode in this podcast feed at the end of next month.
And yeah, don't forget about our daily show, obviously. You can catch it live every weeknight on CBC Radio 1. We also drop a podcast version right here in this feed every night as well. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.